Luke 19, then, and the story of Zacchaeus. You may perhaps have heard of the elderly man from a hillbilly community who was paying his first ever visit to a large shopping mall. Hillbillies live in mountainous parts of rural America and avoid contact wherever possible with towns and shopping centres. So we don't know what led this particular gentleman with his beard and braces to visit this particular department store. But there he was on the ground floor in front of the grey steel doors of the lift. He had never seen a lift before and he had no idea what it was or how it worked. And he stood and watched as an infirm elderly lady with a stick hobbled into the lift and the doors closed behind her. The hillbilly gazed with interest at the closed doors. For a minute or two, nothing seemed to happen. Then the doors parted again, and behold, wonder of wonders, from inside the lift emerged the most glamorous young lady imaginable. And as she passed elegantly by, the hillbilly turned to his son and said, "Son, go get your mother." What, you may ask, does that story have in common with the story of Zacchaeus, recorded by Luke in chapter 19 of his gospel? To which I suppose the honest answer is not a lot, except that both stories are concerned with change. And we're all interested in change. And in Zacchaeus' case, it concerns a change that, far from being superficial and concerned only with outward appearance, goes to the core of his personality. According to an old saying, a man can change his clothes, but not his character. That is fixed. And it seems to most people that to change human nature is beyond human power. But the case of Zacchaeus proves that to be entirely untrue. It's true that we're not told a great deal about his character, in fact, but we don't need to be, because verse 2 says it all. It just says he was a chief tax collector and was rich. Sometimes happens, doesn't it, that when talking to somebody you've not previously met, all goes well in the conversation until you discover what they do for a living. So you might ask, "What do you do?" And she says, "I'm a dentist." And for some unaccountable reason, for the rest of conversation, you open your mouth no more widely than necessary. Or maybe the person says, "Well, I'm a policeman," and you feel slightly guilty and wonder whether he knows something about you. Or even, "I'm a vicar." That has a way of silencing conversations, until somebody uses a swear word and then half seriously says, "Oh, sorry, vicar." Or best of all, "I work for the Inland Revenue." Right, say no more. Well, they're all good and necessary trades, as was tax collecting in the first century in Palestine, Israel. Taxes needed to be paid and collected. And the Romans' way of tax collecting was to find a willing volunteer from the subject people, tell him how much to collect, and as long as he met his target, it didn't matter what he did with the rest. He could do what he liked. And not surprisingly, all tax collectors did well for themselves. And we may assume that a chief tax collector, which is what Zacchaeus was, did very well for himself. He was a chief tax collector and was rich. Luke really didn't need to say he was rich, but he makes the point to underline it. It's rather like it back in chapter 4 when Jesus is in the wilderness and Luke says he ate nothing for many, many days and he was hungry. Well, why does he bother to say that? It's fairly obvious if you don't eat, you're going to be hungry. But it underlines an important point. This man was rich. All tax collectors were unpopular, deservedly so, and a chief tax collector would be especially unpopular. They were collaborators, traitors, really, with the occupying power. And the story of a tax collector's life would not be one of how to win friends and influence people. It would rather be how to lose friends but make a pile along the way. So we've only got to read that second verse to know that this man was thoroughly selfish and thoroughly corrupt, and I think we can say thoroughly sad. He may have been superficially happy, may have been superficially very happy, but you cannot live life in that way, that kind of life, and be deeply satisfied. And God in his goodness will not allow it. We're made for something better than that. We're made to know and to love him. And all the money in the world, especially if it's acquired by dubious means, cannot satisfy the inner longings of the human soul. As somebody put it, it's like high-class confectionery for a starving man. And as old Augustine put it in his prayer, O Lord, you have made us for yourself, and our hearts are ever restless until they find their rest in you. So we may safely say that whatever the outward show, whatever the trappings, Zacchaeus is inwardly a deeply unhappy man. And there are many like him today. I expect you know some. It's possible you might even be one. But when Jesus on this day enters Jericho and is passing through, this day proves to be the most significant day in the whole of this man's life. And by the end of it, he is a very, very different man from the one who begins it. In fact, he's hardly recognizable. There has been a revolution in his heart. And selfishness has given way to love and generosity. And corruption has given way to honesty and integrity. And when we get to verse 8, we find Zacchaeus standing and saying to Jesus, Behold, Lord, half of my goods I give to the poor, and if I have defrauded anyone of anything, I restore it fourfold. Now, ours is a skeptical age, and if we hear that sort of thing today, especially if it's sort of religiously motivated, we're inclined not to believe it. That people will say, well, he may say that, but I bet he's squirreled more than enough in a secret bank account somewhere else and keeping quiet about it. But Jesus is not so easily deceived, and he takes Zacchaeus at his word and says, declares unequivocally, today salvation has come to this house. He is also a son of Abraham. He has found his place among the people of God. So this man is now generous and honest, and he's also happy. It's fairly obvious. I use the word cautiously, because there can, of course, be a kind of superficial jollity, a superficial jolly happiness, which has very little to do with genuine Christian faith and life. But I want to say, and I think we must say, that coming to faith in Jesus does bring a depth of joy and contentment which is really without parallel, cannot be found anywhere else. And it must be so because it's what we were made for. And God's way is a good way, the good way to be. Blessed is more the Bible word than happy, but it means happy, but not in that superficial way. So the Psalms begin with Psalm 1. Blessed is the one who does not walk in the way of sinners or stand in the seat of scoffers. Stand in the way of sinners or sit in the seat of scoffers. But his delight is in the law of the Lord. It is a good place to be. And Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount says, Blessed, happy are the poor in spirit, the meek, the merciful, the hungry. The hungry. So it is not a superficial happiness. Blessed are those who mourn over their sin. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake. And personal allegiance to Jesus brings no shortage of difficulties, as Zacchaeus will doubtless discover, but it is a privilege to carry them for him and with him, and it's worth it every step of the way. Now, how does this extraordinary change in this man's life come about? Well, in his case, in Zacchaeus' case, it begins with simple curiosity. That's where it all starts. Verse 3, we have curiosity. He was seeking to see who Jesus was. The word had obviously got around that this interesting person was coming, and crowds were gathering along the way. And if you've been up in London on the Mall on a royal wedding day or the Queen's birthday or something, you'll get the picture. Everyone wants just a glimpse of Her Majesty as she passes by. Now, the crowds in Jericho wouldn't have been that great, but they were big enough for Zacchaeus, who is clearly small, to be unable to see. And so he runs on ahead and climbs up a sycamore tree. I'm always pleased to see that. I'm glad there's a good use for a sycamore tree. We have one in our garden. It's right pain. I spend most of the autumn clearing up its leaves. But Zacchaeus obviously is pleased to find a sycamore tree, and up he goes in order to be able to see Jesus. Curiosity is where it begins. And that is a good thing, isn't it? It's right to be curious about Jesus, to want to think about him, to want to consider him, to listen to him, and to ponder his relevance for us in 2017. And in our culture and context, I guess not many people are curious about Jesus, sadly, too familiar perhaps with his name. And indifference to Jesus is a very sad thing. But by contrast, it is wonderful when someone's curiosity is aroused. And for whatever reason, they begin to realize that there's something here or someone here who they've never really thought about. And it's time they did. So curiosity is where it begins. I don't think we'd say he's an earnest seeker. He's just curious. But curious enough to climb up a tree and have a look. And curiosity leads to an encounter. It's the second thing. Curiosity leads to encounter. And Zacchaeus gets a lot more than he bargained for. It was, I think, in June 1966 that the Queen and the Duke of Edinburgh drove past my family home. Our home is in the depths of the Suffolk countryside, no other house in sight. But it's next to a straight piece of road, and 1 mile further on down the road was the Snape Maltings Concert Hall, and the Queen had come to open it at the beginning of the Aldborough Festival that year. And I was away at the time, and I was sorry to miss it. But my parents and a few invited friends stood at the first floor window to watch and wave. And because it was the depths of the countryside, there was no one else around at all. And predictably, they received royal waves in return, which was very nice. But the cavalcade was only briefly there, and moments later, of course, it had gone past, and they were watching it from behind until the final car disappeared around the far corner. Now, just suppose that on seeing my father, the Queen had ordered her driver to stop. Suppose she had then emerged and looked up and addressed him by name and said, "Hugh, come down quickly. I wish to take tea with you today." It's a rather lovely idea, isn't it? Now, my father was a man of impeccable manners, and though doubtless flustered by that, as my mother would have been, "Help, I've only got half a Victoria sponge and it's already 3 days old." Though there would have been consternation, it would also have been a very great honour that Her Majesty should stoop so low as to take tea in our home, even with the loose-fitting stretch covers on the sofa and the threadbare old Persian carpet on the floor. She wanted to come. Now, that is not a day that you would forget, is it? But it's what Jesus says to Zacchaeus. In verse 5, when he came to the place, he looked up and said to him, "Zacchaeus, hurry, come down, for I must stay at your house today." And it's striking that he knows him by name. We're not told how. Maybe he'd already asked somebody. Maybe Zacchaeus was notorious in Jericho. Everybody knew him. Maybe it was just supernatural insight. We're not told. But Zacchaeus might well have thought, "Hey, how does he know my name?" But the important thing is that Jesus does know his name. And it's extraordinary but true that Jesus today knows each of us by name. There's no one here this morning whose name he does not know. He knows your name, which means he knows you profoundly, personally, individually. He knows his name. And having addressed him by name, Jesus then gives him an order. "Hurry and come down." Christian people have sometimes read that as a kind of parable, as if it's saying that you can't have dealings with Jesus unless you're prepared to come down a peg or two, to humble yourself and let go of your pride and climb down as Zacchaeus does from your perch. And that is certainly true, in that pride is the great obstacle to Christian faith, and it's the only thing ultimately that will stop anyone from believing in Jesus today. But I guess a simpler explanation of why he comes down is that he can't really let Jesus into his house unless he does. Even so, I think we can safely say that Zacchaeus is more used to giving orders than to obeying them. This guy is a chief tax collector. People did what he said, and if they didn't, it would be the worse for them. But for once in his life, he's on the receiving end. There is authority here in the voice of Jesus. "Zacchaeus, hurry and come down. I must stay at your house." There is real authority in those words. And yet it is a humble authority, isn't it? It's an authority that is clothed with humility because he wishes to be a guest in Zacchaeus' home. He's not telling to sweep it and get ready or anything. He just wishes to be on the receiving end of his hospitality. And that's very significant because supremely in that culture, the receiving, giving and receiving of hospitality was very significant. It implied respect. It implied acceptance. It implied a desire to know and to be known. So it's not as if Jesus is just hungry and reckoning that a tax collector's kitchen will be a good pit stop on the way to Jerusalem. No, it is Zacchaeus himself he's interested in. And he orders him down from the tree because he wants to meet him on a level and to meet him face to face. And that's very instructive for you and me today. To become a Christian today involves recognizing that supreme authority of Jesus. He knows us by name, and he has the right to issue orders and to have control of our lives. But he does not do so arbitrarily, and he doesn't do for his own sake, as if power, as it were, mattered to him in that way. Now, the reality is that Zacchaeus, for all his wealth, all his worldly success, is lost. It's the word Jesus uses. This is a man who doesn't know why he came into the world. He doesn't know what will happen when he leaves the world. He doesn't honestly know what the point is of being in this world, or whether indeed there is any point there at all. He is lost. And if you were here last Sunday morning, you'll know what I mean by his being like that contrabassoon player, I think it was, something like that, in the opera house, who creeps into the orchestra pit halfway through the evening from the back and plays the bars that are allotted to him and leaves soon afterwards, without any understanding at all of the wider story that's being played out on the stage above, and in which he has just a small and rather puzzling part. He doesn't know why he's there, really. And Zacchaeus is lost. And therefore he needs to come under authority. He needs to come under the gracious authority of Jesus, who invites himself into Zacchaeus' home and his life, which was and is the whole purpose of his coming. Why did Jesus come into this world? People give different answers. Jesus' answer is there in verse 10. The Son of Man came to seek and to save the lost. Now, I can't show you lostness on a screen. I could show you poverty easily enough. I could show you disease easily enough. I can't show you lostness because it goes deeper than that. And it's much easier to disguise. Now, remember, the narrative began with Zacchaeus doing the seeking. He was seeking to see who Jesus was. But what he then finds is that this Jesus is actually seeking him. And his own seeking, Zacchaeus' seeking, is a bit tentative. Jesus would have passed by and that would have been that. He wouldn't have gone running after him. Rather like the Tour de France a year ago. Do you remember that? A year or two ago, there he was on St. John's Road. And we stood by the fence or on the pavement and whoosh, and it had gone. But Jesus stops and looks up and tells him to come down because his seeking is anything but tentative and momentary. He is the one on the search. It is why he came, to seek and to save the lost. Now, seeking and saving is not really our kind of language, is it? But we understand search and rescue, don't we? And that's what he's talking about. Search and rescue is what Jesus is about. I never used to believe in a God, said a well-known author some years ago, nor did I feel under any necessity to invent one, but I came to the surprising conclusion that there was a God who was looking for me. And so, for Zacchaeus, he gets far more than he bargained for when he first climbed up that tree. Curiosity led to encounter, and then thirdly, encounter led to change. I don't know if you remember that unfortunate incident in the 2010 general election when Prime Minister Gordon Brown on the campaign trail referred to a person with whom he'd been talking as, quote, some bigoted old lady. You may remember that. It was unfortunate because the microphone picked it up and it quickly became headline news. And the old lady, on being told how she'd been described, was visibly shocked. And so the unfortunate Prime Minister had to go back into her house where he stayed behind a closed door without a microphone for some 40 minutes. And we were not told what transpired during those 40 minutes. Though a number of people, many people, enjoyed speculating about it. This was a spirited northern lady, and I guess it must have been very awkward for her visitor. Now, Luke tells us very little about what happened, well, nothing actually, about what happened in conversation with Zacchaeus behind his door. But he does tell us what the onlookers thought about it. They all grumbled, verse 7, and they said, he has gone in to be the guest of a man who is a sinner. Which is a simple statement of fact, that is the objective report, if you like. And they don't like it one bit. They grumble and mutter. Now, if the Queen had stopped in June 1966 at Shepherd's Cottage, Blackstall Heath, Woodbridge, Suffolk, and told my father to get the kettle on, it would have been very surprising. But nobody would have thought it shocking. But these people do. What is this preacher guy doing, giving time to a rogue like that? They find it shocking. But we need to see it through Zacchaeus' eyes, because he's the one on the receiving end. And for him, the fact that Jesus is coming into the house of a sinner is the whole beauty of it. He knows he's a sinner, and he also knows that no one other than fellow rogues would have anything to do with him. But the beauty of this visit is that here is someone who will. Here is someone who knows him and who singles him out. Here is someone who reads him well, peculiarly well, and still wants to meet him and talk with him and engage with him and enjoy his hospitality and establish a meaningful relationship with him. And so this Jesus, for all the authority of his person, treats this man with respect. He accepts him, sinner though he is, and knows himself to be. Now, is that how you think of Jesus? It should be, not least for us who often speak about making him better known. Is this the kind of Jesus whom we want people to meet? Because this isn't just something that happened a long time ago. It's a narrative for today. Jesus didn't come to call the righteous. He came to call sinful people to himself. It's not the healthy who need a doctor. It's the sick. And Jesus is the same yesterday, today, and forever. So the encounter which follows curiosity leads to a change which is extraordinary. Revolutionary really isn't too strong a word. Verse 8 again, behold, Lord, half of my goods I give to the poor. I guess our treasurer would be delighted to hear that sort of news. And if I have defrauded anyone of anything, I restore it fourfold. But you see how important the order of events is here? I think some people would rewrite the order. The first thing that happens is that Zacchaeus meets Jesus face to face. And it is that encounter, that meeting, that results in change, so that integrity comes in place of fraud and generosity in place of greed. And it hasn't come about by giving Zacchaeus lectures or sermons on morality. It comes about from this unexpected encounter. He doesn't change his behavior in order to get ready to meet Jesus. He doesn't have time apart from the else. He doesn't begin by saying, oh, I better pull my socks up and raise my game and start giving money away and so on. That would never have lasted. There'd be no motivation for change and no power and no dynamic to bring it about. No, it is when he encounters Jesus one-to-one that he is liberated and set free, because that's what the Savior does to people who are trapped, who are enslaved to their selfish desires. And that, if we're honest, is all of us in our natural state until Jesus sets us free. Zacchaeus is a picture of a man let out of his cell. Whoever commits sin, says Jesus elsewhere, is a slave to sin. But if the Son of God sets you free, you will be free indeed. And every true Christian knows the meaning of that. Where there is genuine encounter with Jesus, people change. And if they don't change, there has not been a genuine encounter. And if someone claims to know Jesus, then all the time their attitudes and priorities are no different really from those of their non-Christian neighbors, then their Christian profession is frankly worthless. You cannot have dealings with Jesus without being changed. And no aspect of anyone's life is more revealing than their attitude to money, of which Zacchaeus had a very great deal, their attitude to money and the things that money can buy. Curiosity leads to encounter, leads to change. Thomas Chalmers was a 19th century preacher who only became a Christian after being ordained in the Church of England. That's interesting, isn't it? And it's been true of a number. And he wrote later on as follows. Before I was converted, I preached to the drunk to give up drink. I told the blasphemer to give up using God's name wrongly. I told the idle to stop being lazy. But the drunk remained drunk, the blasphemer continued blaspheming, and the idle remained idle. And then I was converted. This is the vicar speaking, remember? And then I was converted, and I preached the gospel of the free grace of God. I stopped telling people to sort themselves out and told them that God had done it all. And a funny thing happened. The drunk became sober, the blasphemer stopped swearing, and the idol began to work.